This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon, and welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. Today's topic is going to be healthcare journalism, and my guest is Susan Dentzer. Susan is joining us by telephone from the East Coast, where she is editor-in-chief of Health Affairs. Health Affairs is a journal of health policy thought and research, and it explores health policy issues of concern both to domestic, and international issues. And prior to that, she spent a considerable amount of time starting and leading a unit at the NewsHour on public TV, and then went to become editor-in-chief at Health Affairs. Susan, welcome to Line One.
Nice to be with you, Dr. Woodard. Thanks for having me.
My interest in having you on the program originated with your New England Journal of Medicine article. There's been always a big interest in the New England Journal and social issues around medical care, and I'm not someone who considers myself a healthcare journalist, just someone who's trying to get good information out about healthcare, but I worry about what I do and the ethics of what I do, and so I wanted to bring you on and talk about what really is healthcare journalism and some of the problems that you might see and some of the benefits of it. So if we could just start by talking about what journalism is all about, what its purpose, and perhaps maybe some guiding principles.
Well, journalism broadly, I think, has multiple purposes. We obviously are there to report the news, whatever that is. And, of course, in our context, we usually think of, we take the word literally, news, you know, is what's new. It's not what's old, or it's not what's routine or expected. You know, the old saw is that if journalism reported reality, the front page would be full of things like 900 planes landed safely today without incident at Reagan National Airport in Washington, D.C. And, of course, we don't do that. We basically take that for granted that we report the airline disasters that occur. So that's one purpose of journalism. Of course, other purposes include providing context and perspective on current events, providing analysis. Sections of major newspapers and other organizations will give kind of very often news you can use. You know, here's what you need to know about how to invest safely in the current amid the current financial debacle, et cetera, et cetera. So there are lots and lots of different purposes. In my New England Journal of Medicine piece, I was trying to draw a distinction as to what is the role of many healthcare journalists or people writing about health information, because I do think there, in certain circumstances, we have an additional job, which is that we are giving people news and information about health that they may, in fact, may act on. And because they may act on it, whether they're doctors reading it, whether they're patients, et cetera, et cetera, we have to hold ourselves to yet a different standard than may be the case for some journalists who are mainly focused on just reporting the news or getting a piece on the front page and therefore reporting it in a particularly convivial way that somehow might shade the information in such a way that people who used it to act on their health might end up making the wrong decision.
Give us some more cogent examples of what you're talking about.
Well, for example, a classic case was in 2002, a major study called the Women's Health Initiative that had gone on for a number of years was basically an arm of the study was ended amid great upheaval because this study had been designed to look at the effects of hormone therapy on women. And a leading suspicion at the time that caused the study to be started was that taking hormone therapy could be good for women's health, specifically good for women's heart health, in addition to dealing with menopausal symptoms like hot flashes and so forth and so on. The study, one particular arm of the study was terminated early because quite the opposite began to be seen in data. Specifically, it was seen that taking hormone therapy for certain the women who were enrolled in the study had higher rates of breast cancer, higher rates of heart disease, higher rates of cardiovascular events, and so forth and so on. So rather than being an aid to health, it looked like quite the opposite, that this was a dangerous addition to, or a dangerous thing to be doing, or it could actually make your health worse. Well, this was reported, and essentially it caused almost a major panic among the literally millions of women across the country who were taking hormone therapy and their physicians. The information was rolled out very, very quickly in news conferences. It wasn't packaged in advance through some of the major physician organizations that are concerned about these issues in women, for women. And it was reported in a very kind of lopsided way. Journalists, a lot of journalists just simply did not know what to make of the data. And so they tended, many of them, of us, tended to overreact and basically report the data in such a way that it seemed to suggest that if you took one more pill, you were a goner. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, women who had been on this medication for many, many years in some instances, some of them just stopped it overnight. They certainly were deluging their physicians with phone calls, what should I do, et cetera, et cetera. And that was a kind of a classic case where, yes, it was clear from the data that you should certainly not take these medications if you wanted to improve your health. The only reason to take them was to deal with menopausal symptoms, and probably it was best in those instances to take them for as short a time as possible and at as low a dose as possible. But it wasn't going to be the case that if you had been taking it for 8 years, if you took one more pill, you were going to get breast cancer versus not. And it essentially what happened was, I think, we threw a lot of the country into, certainly women, into an unnecessary panic. And it was basically because we were reporting the, quote, news, as opposed to reporting it from a standpoint of asking, okay, this is true. This study really changes our picture of the drug. Where do we go from here? What's a prudent course of action for women from this point forward? Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is something that we replicate in smaller ways, less momentous ways, in many of the reports that we file as journalists on medical studies.
What leads to that? Why? What can be done, I guess, is another way of thinking about it. We don't know what we should do until we understand why this may be happening. Is it a lack of time? Is it a lack of resources financially? Is it a lack of understanding of how science progresses? A combination of all of these. And so what's happening and what can we do about it?
I would say all of the above. At the fundamental root of it, though, I think is a lack of sophistication among many of us about data, about statistics, about scientific studies, and so on. And I want to say, I have thought for many years that it's a good thing that journalists cannot be sued for malpractice, because many of us would have been sent up the river many, many years ago. And frankly, I was once one of them. I was reporting for many years on economics and business. I moved over time into health policy. Suddenly, when I got to the NewsHour, I noticed that nobody was doing much of anything on healthcare, and suddenly there was a great call for many of us to report on medical studies. Well, I had been in the trenches long enough to know at that stage of my journalism career, I had a pretty good handle on knowing what I didn't know. And so I was able to dive pretty deeply into a lot of issues involving understanding how to approach medical studies, and already from the economics reporting I had done, I had a pretty good knowledge of statistics. So I had a leg up in a certain sense, but it still was a learning curve for me, as I think it is for many journalists. If you are somebody who doesn't have a statistical background, doesn't have a scientific background, and are suddenly thrown on this beat, which happens day in and day out in this country, and more so now that journalism is under such enormous financial stress. Literally, there are people being thrown on these stories who just have no business being thrown on them because they're one of the few people who are left at their newspaper or what have you. And they, by the way, they sense this. They know this. Right. I mean, some of the survey work that has been done by the Association for Healthcare Journalists, among others, suggests that we know this. We have full awareness of our many inadequacies. But if you're thrown on these stories and suddenly you have to know what a p-value is, for example, and you don't, which is basically a statistical device that enables you to understand whether a study may have been due to sheer chance, whether the results of the study may have been due to sheer chance as much as anything else, or if you suddenly have to decide because your editor only wants a very short lead, whether you're going to use absolute risks quoted in a study or relative risks. And that this, for example, was at play in the hormone therapy study. The relative risks for the group of women who were taking hormone therapy for breast cancer, their odds of getting breast cancer relative to the group that was on a placebo was up 22%. And if you state the case like that, your odds of taking or your odds of getting breast cancer if you take the drug are 22% higher. That sounds like a lot. If you state it in terms of the absolute risks, you know, which are something like if you're taking this drug, 8 out of 10,000 more women will develop breast cancer. So for every 10,000 women who take the drug, there will be 8 additional cases of breast cancer. That tends to state the results very, very differently. And if you're a journalist and you don't know which is which, and if you're a journalist who's, in addition to not knowing which is which, you're kind of inclined to go with the scariest version of the story, then you might use the relative risk numbers as opposed to the absolute risk numbers. And so when those kinds of things happen, and they're not even so much errors, they're kind of choices that journalists make about how to report news that kind of compound on each other. And so you end up providing a story that it may even in some senses be accurate, but it's just not the full picture. And if people use it as a basis to make some decision with respect to their health, again, as I said earlier, you might be leading them to do something that just is not a wise choice.
It seems to me in a much bigger framework of thinking is that really science has really come of age in the last, I don't know, 50 years in the sense that it is affecting every bit of what we're doing in the public. It's important for judges in the legislature, in schools. And we really haven't done a good job, but I think we're beginning to catch up. I see courses for judges about how to make decisions and understand scientific and technological presentations or information. And I think what you're saying is that subspecialization in healthcare journalism is now realizing the importance of catching up so that we can communicate this information more effectively to the public. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. And if you look at some of the major issues that we face as a society, let alone as a world, science is at the root of them. A greater understanding of science is at the root of them. Global climate change, et cetera. So it is critically important, I think, that all of us be more scientifically literate, starting with journalists. But, of course, it sure wouldn't hurt if the public were more scientifically literate either.
Yeah, absolutely.
In many respects, it would read stories more intelligently. It would also, frankly, put greater demand on many of us to report these pieces in a smarter way.
It seems like, to me, I at least I would like to see the journalists or even the institutions take the opportunity to educate the public about that. Let me give you a prime example is the issue about SSRIs and the newer group of antidepressants and adolescent suicide. The same thing came out. There was a big report or one study that suggested perhaps there was a slightly increased risk of adolescent suicide that while they're taking the SSRIs. What wasn't brought out obviously at the very beginning was this fact that we'd been seeing adolescent suicides decrease dramatically since they've been being used. The report came out that a black box warning was put on by the FDA, and then pretty well documented increase in adolescent suicides as people became scared and stopped taking these medications. And so I was somewhat critical. I think the FDA is in a very difficult spot. They need to do what they need to do to protect the public, but I would think they also have an obligation to first do no harm, like I do, and they could have taken the advantage of the opportunity to explain maybe there is an increased risk, but there's also a risk of not taking these medications, and you should be discussing more clearly with your providers about weighing those risks one way or the other. But I feel like in that sense, the FDA missed the opportunity, and certainly the standard healthcare journalism missed that opportunity.
Well, this was a big, big quandary internally for the Food and Drug Administration. And interestingly, I covered that story at the NewsHour, so I'm familiar with it. Good. Essentially, what happened was, of course, as you recall, studies had been, very small studies had been done by pharmaceutical companies, which it didn't even show an increase in suicides. It showed an increase in something called suicidality,
right.
which is suicidal ideation, which basically means, did you have thoughts about suicide? Now, some people will say, well, that's a distinction without a difference, because if you're thinking about suicide, you may or you will go on to do it. And that's frankly just not clear. It is sometimes the case, and it is often not the case. Anybody who has a teenager knows that teenagers will think about suicide or threaten it, but that doesn't mean that they're going to actually carry it out. So this is a murky area. But in addition to that, these studies had been, in effect, buried or not made public. And so that when they did become public knowledge, there was a combined effect, first of all, of just alarm that this information had not been out when some of these drugs had been approved, but also this concern that thinking about suicide might lead to suicide. In addition to that, in Britain, there was a lot of attention being focused on the fact that many of these drugs had not been proven to be effective in treatment of adolescents. And so, in fact, only one of them, Prozac, was recommended for use.
Right.
So you sort of threw all of these things in a pot, and the FDA was under a lot of pressure to say something or do something.
Right.
And there were, of course, some people arguing that these drugs should be pulled off the market for adolescents, or basically the FDA should basically say that they were not appropriate for use, that we should go the way the United Kingdom did and only recommend use of Prozac, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a lot of pushback from child psychiatrists and others who were worried about just what you pointed out, who were feared that the result of this would be a huge decline in prescriptions and a big increase in suicide. So when the FDA went with a black box warning, that was just kind of a middle road path. It was designed to sort of satisfy everybody. And then, of course, like most gestures of that sort, it ended up satisfying nobody. I think if with the benefit of hindsight, we can see that it was probably a good thing to put healthcare providers broadly on alert about the dangers of putting people on these medications. It is the case. There have been for years a phenomenon noted, some people called it rollback, which is that if you go on these medications, it can be the case that you can get a surge of energy. And maybe that surge of energy, you don't feel great yet, but you feel one of the symptoms of depression can, of course, be lack of energy. So if you're still feeling depressed, but you suddenly have more energy, that could lead you to carry out an act of suicide. This has been noted over time by many many mental health providers. So putting the broader healthcare system on alert that this was a potential phenomenon, putting particularly primary care providers who increasingly were prescribing these medications on notice that they had that children who were put adolescents who were put on these medications really did need to be watched very closely was probably a good thing. The other side of the coin was that, as you've noted, there was a decline in prescribing, particularly among primary care providers. And in the end, there was noted some at least modest rise in suicides. And we'll have to see over time really what the final effects of this are.
All right. We have to take a short break, and then we'll be back and we'll discuss this some more. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Hi, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm talking with Susan Dentzer today. She is the editor-in-chief of Health Affairs Journal, and we're talking about healthcare journalism. If you've got questions or comments, why don't you give us a call? 550-8433 is our local number. You can also reach us at a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Or you can email me direct at lineone@kska.org. And the usual reminder, if you're listening between 8 and 9 Anchorage time, that's a taped rebroadcast. We're live right now between 2 and 3 local time. What are the big health journalism, healthcare journalism stories right now?
Well, of course, a major focus is what is going to happen with health reform efforts in the Congress and as between the Congress and the Obama administration. There's a, of course, well-known, well-documented set of issues that really need to be dealt with. Lack of access to health care among the 45-plus million uninsured individuals in the country. A very large sense that we are not necessarily getting value for our dollars when it comes to health care. We, as a nation, spend 50% more per capita on health care than the next biggest spenders, Luxembourg and Switzerland. But if we look at some of our key health outcomes or indicators of health status, we're pretty far down the pack. We're, I believe it is 45th in terms of life expectancy in the world, 29th in terms of infant mortality. We have some of the major studies that have been done on healthcare quality across the country indicate problems. A famous RAND study published in 2003 asked, how much of the time do Americans get agreed upon effective health care? And the number was 55%. So it was, roughly speaking, a coin toss. If you were an individual, say, who was taken to an emergency room after having had a heart attack, did you get an aspirin within an hour? Well, you know, roughly speaking, half the time you did, half the time you didn't. So we know we have a lot of issues, and the biggest of all, of course, is the ongoing rise in health spending, which at about 7% a year is more than double the rate of inflation, certainly much more than double the rate of inflation now, and it's vastly outstrips the growth in workers' wages. And over time, it continues to feed a scenario where healthcare is simply unaffordable for many Americans. So how the Congress and how President Obama are going to strike some kind of a deal, if they are, to deal with this is probably topic A, certainly where I live in the Washington, D.C. area among health policy journalists. That is indeed topic A at the moment.
Is anything going to happen? I remember about a year ago asking Uwe Reinhardt that question, and he didn't think we were ready yet. My thought back then was, as more and more middle class get to realize what it's like to not have health insurance, that sooner or later this is going to happen. It's just like we keep pushing up the cost to everybody, and eventually more and more people are going to be hurt very badly financially because of our healthcare system. So I thought the time was right, and I certainly don't think we've had a better chance in the last 15 or 20 years. We not only understand we're having a problem, but I think more and more people are getting hurt. Can we get it done now? And if not, why not?
When I first got to Washington, some wise person told me, you should never trust anybody who tells you what Congress will do, because that person will surely lie to you about other things as well. And I've always taken that advice quite seriously. I think what we could do is lay out some potential scenarios of what could happen. So here are some scenarios. Well, one scenario is that something would be enacted this year, or perhaps pushed over until next year, but in this congressional session, which of course goes for 2 years, this year and next year. And then the question becomes, what's the something? What's in the package that could get enacted? And then you would look at things like, well, do we want to create a new system through which people would access health insurance? And then you start to look at things like the president's proposal to create a health insurance exchange. This is what's been done in Massachusetts, where the state created this health insurance connector. It's essentially a giant purchasing pool in which you standardize benefit packages, and all the private insurers come in, Aetna, United, Blue Cross, et cetera, and they say, here's our price for these insurance packages. And then individuals can buy them, companies can buy them on behalf of their workers, et cetera, et cetera. So that could be one piece in the proposal. A question mark, though, is President Obama has proposed having a new public plan be available in that purchasing pool. Would that make it? Well, there's a great deal of support for that in Washington. There's also an enormous amount of opposition to that, particularly among people who are worried that that public plan would be, say, like Medicare, and that it would be subsidized, and subsidized by the taxpayers at a time where, over the long term, we face enormous liabilities on the Medicare program, on the Medicaid program, and don't have any clear idea of how we're going to pay for those. Why would you expand public coverage is the argument. So then what we could ask is, well, would there be some subsidies to help lower-income individuals afford coverage through this new health insurance exchange? Well, maybe. How big would those subsidies be, and where would that money come from? The president proposed in his budget blueprint several weeks ago a health reform reserve fund, which was about $634 billion over 10 years. About half of that was going to be made up of tax hikes on higher income taxpayers, specifically limiting their deductions. But as soon as that proposal went up to the Hill, some key people on the Hill, including Democrats, Kent Conrad, who heads the Budget Committee, and Senator Max Baucus of South Dakota, who heads the Finance Committee, basically indicated that proposal was a non-starter, and that was half of the financing of the package. So you sort of basically, at this point, I think any intelligent observer has a whole lot of trouble saying, I know exactly what's going to be in the package, and I know what's going to pass. As I say, a scenario would be that something passes that does puts the country on a road to expand coverage, puts the country on the road to subsidize at least some of that coverage, although maybe not immediately, given the economic downturn that we're suffering. And then maybe a package also does something to try to deliver on a more efficient and effective healthcare system. And beyond that, it's at this point, I think, hard to figure out exactly what could or would happen.
Okay. Let me give our listeners some contact information. Again, my guest today is Susan Dentzer, Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs Journal in Washington, D.C. We're talking about healthcare journalism and some of the important stories in healthcare journalism and how health journalism affects also how we make decisions. So if you've got questions or comments, 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433, toll-free 1-888-353-5752, and you can email me at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Another component of Obama's spending on his new, I forget what it's called, the omnibus money that he's already put in, a big part of it is related to, or some of it, to health records and updating electronic medical records and so forth. And we had an email from a guest that mentions that she's a little worried about that in the sense that when she's looked at copies of records, she finds a number of errors, and these errors are now going to be promoted or promulgated all over the place with electronic medical records. And then also that she hears very few good things said about medical records from providers. And she's worried about, is this really where we should be putting some effort? Are you aware of the negative comments or the other side of the coin from this effort towards updating medical communications electronically?
Yes. In fact, this was a piece. This was a portion of the stimulus law that was adopted in February, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And in that law was a portion that was dubbed high tech, which is essentially health information technology. And under that provision of ERA, as it's called, the stimulus law, $19 billion was to be set aside to invest across the board in health information technology over the next several years. The part of that will go to the expansion of electronic health records, but it really will be broadly based across a lot of health information technology. So it will not just be electronic health records. It'll be something known as probably computerized physician order entry and some other very sophisticated ways of marrying information technology to healthcare. What I think people should understand is that healthcare, from an information technology perspective, has been one of the most backward industries in America. If you think about banking, you can go any place in the United States, let alone any place now, not any place, but many, many places in the world, stick your ATM card in a machine and get cash instantly. And that's that didn't happen by magic. That happened because the banking industry said, we have got to have systems of information technology which will allow people to communicate across banks, across all kinds of distances in order to have a common access to their finances. If you take the healthcare sector, some people joke, you know, if you're in Las Vegas and you go into a casino and you say, I want to borrow $2,000 to gamble with, they will take your credit card, they will go into the back room, they'll run your numbers through a data mining company, which will tell them in about 3 minutes, do you have a home mortgage? How much do you owe on it? Do you have an IRA? How much is in your IRA? They have incredible access to financial information to know exactly whether you're ever going to pay off this lousy $2,000 loan on your credit card and whether the casino should give it to you. Now, by the same token, if you walk out the door of that casino, fall off the pavement, crack your skull open and are taken to a hospital, what do they know about you? Nothing. Nothing. Mm-hmm. They don't know what your blood type is. They don't know if you fell off the pavement because you were drunk. You know, they don't know if you fell off the pavement because you're an epileptic and you are given to seizures. You know, and the most that they'll know about you is if you were clever enough to bring your insurance card with you, they'll at least know that you have coverage and who to bill it to. And it is frankly, I think, to many people, amazing that Americans have stood for this for so long. Part of the problem is indeed that our healthcare system is so fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at who's worried about health information technology and who's fearful of it, very often it is smaller physician practices. A large core of physician practices in America still are made up of 1 to 4 physicians practicing alone. They're worried about the cost of investing in these. And frankly, sometimes they're just mm-hmm. sort of technology averse. I have a physician who's determined to retire before he has to put an electronic health record. But if you go to systems that have used them broadly, and you ask people there, would you like to go back to the era before you had health information technology, they would say never, because it is such a powerful tool that enables them to practice better medicine. And I think that's the important point here. It's not health information technology is not seen as an end to itself. It's a tool that enables providers to be smarter about who are their patients, what's already been done to them, do we need to duplicate a lab test or do we have it here sitting right before us because it's in the electronic record, do I have clear indication that this patient I have who has diabetes has had a steadily worsening hemoglobin A1C level for the last year, and therefore do I understand fully what's inherent in treating this patient now, et cetera, et cetera. It's really at its best a tool that enables healthcare to be as smart about healthcare today as, this is probably not the best era to say banking, to invoke banking as a great enterprise, but we will all acknowledge that it's a great virtue of our system is that we can use our ATM cards just about anywhere in the country. And to have that kind of access to information about something that really matters, like your health, when we already have it about our money, probably is a good thing.
Yeah, I would concur. I've had actually medical electronic medical records since 1996. I was one of the ones that really got in on it. I wouldn't change for a second. But the problem is that if I want to talk to a computer at a hospital near me, I've got to pay another $20,000 in cost just so the two computers can talk. There's no protocol. And we were all waiting as long as 1998, 2000, and we were told that the government was going to come up with this method that all the different companies would be able to program that in. And it's just it's never happened. So it seems like there's these regulations or this protocol that has to be established that I'm sure although I don't know for a fact, but I assume the banking industry uses and allows that to happen so much easier than we can within the healthcare system.
Yes, and I sometimes joke kind of sardonically, banking got there because it was about something really important.
Money.
Which was your money. Who cares about your health?
Exactly.
Whether you're going to live or die. But there has been a push, slow but steady, to get all vendors of health information technology to move to what's called interoperability, to basically prevent the problem that you talked about. So that, for example, the Winona, Minnesota hospital system, which has a terrific electronic record system, so that they can, when a patient gets transferred, say, from Winona to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, that the record could move seamlessly into the Mayo Clinic. At the moment, it can't, because the Mayo has a great system, but it's totally different from the Winona system, which is a great system. And interoperability has long been acknowledged to be key. It's been very, very hard to get there, and basically it's because it's been a slow drip of getting the vendors to agree on common platforms. I think that at least the stimulus law language pushes the government to get more actively involved in this. But it's a big issue now, certainly in Washington, about how that's going to happen. The new National Information Coordinator who will be working at HHS is going to be Dr. David Blumenthal of Harvard, who is just a terrific and very smart guy, a clinician who came out of the Partners Harvard Health System, and deeply understands the issues that affect clinicians in converting to health information technology, and understands the issues. And it's going to be under his aegis now to figure out how we move as a society to interoperability in a way that that actually gets there, that makes it possible for electronic records to move seamlessly. And I think also many, many of the other provisions of the law, his office will be has been given the role of overseeing how these things play out. For example, the law basically certifies that this information is owned by the patient, so that patients are supposed to be able to get access to the records held in their behalf. Well, making sure that that is actually effectuated is going to be a big deal, because various systems are going to find reasons to consider it inconvenient, probably, to make this information available to patients. Well, under the law now, it's going to have to be. So it's going to be a big, big task to make all this work. And I think in the end, the challenge is going to be making sure that what comes out of it truly is better health care, because that's the point of the entire exercise, as I said earlier.
All right. I'm going to take another short break, and then we've got a couple of callers we want to get to. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Support for Line 1 comes from Lake Otis Pharmacy, providing service to the community for over 20 years with prescription insurance, satellites, and medical equipment for your healthcare needs. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor. And support for KSKA comes from Dr. Colleen Murphy, OBGYN, women's healthcare provider and advocate, serving Alaska women since 1987.
This is Line 1, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking with Susan Dentzer, Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs Journal, a health policy journal in Washington, D.C. We have a caller I'd like to take right now. It's Diane, I guess it is. Diane, you're on Line 1. Hello?
Hi. I'd like to clarify something, that there's an assumption that these electronic records that are, especially the ones in the hospital, are going to be accessible to the doctors. And I just read something on the web that where a bunch of the doctors were complaining that those medical records went into the accounting people and they never got to see them. So the jury is still out exactly how to do it. And I was very surprised in reading this website that I can't remember, there's so many different software packages out there that I don't think they're going to be able to talk to each other. And my primary care physician, just when I brought up to her recently, said that she'd just heard from a colleague who said, oh, gee, I just found a software package that suits my needs, and it only takes me twice as long to do the work that I normally did. And also, as I brought up in my email, I'm very concerned about corrections. And are those electronic records mine? And do I get a chance to correct them? Because I'm finding that my doctor's records, when I get copies of them, are at times very wrong.
Well, you bring up a lot of issues. Just on the first one, as I said, the ERA, the stimulus law, makes it clear that patients own the records. So you are going to, by law, have to have access to them. So the ability then to basically find errors and ask the system to correct them will certainly be there. It's in nobody's interest for anybody to have erroneous information. A healthcare provider, the last thing they want is to have the wrong dose of the drug that you were actually given recorded in the record, et cetera, et cetera. So it's hard for me to imagine that there's going to be a big problem with people's ability to correct information if in fact it's erroneous, once it's pointed out to healthcare providers. It will be in their interest to correct the record. On the issue of basically smaller practices adopting electronic health records, everybody who's been through this understands that it essentially requires doctors to redo what's called workflow in their offices. Because basically, to take full advantage of the efficiencies that you could gain through electronic health records does mean you have to change the way your office is structured and the way patients come in the door and what they do with their time. I mean, even things like, You know, most doctors are used to having patients fill out the clipboard, and then dutifully somebody comes along and inputs it. Well, something as simple as basically having the patient actually sit down at the computer and type in the information in the clipboard would be one way of approaching it. Or you have the patient walk up and sit next to someone else in the office who's typing that information in live. You know, even that is a change for a tiny physician practice, and you shouldn't underestimate the fact that these changes are going to have to be made, and some providers are clearly going to find them a pain in the neck. But if what comes out of it is, I mean, frankly, do I want to get rid of the darn clipboard? I sure do. I filled out enough of those in my life. I find it annoying when I have to go and tell the doctor for the 80th time what my address is. Do I have every expectation that my doctor should figure out a way to redo his practice differently to accommodate my needs as a patient? You bet I do. So to some degree, this is going to be a little bit of a tug of war between whose convenience matters the most, the doctors or the patients. And then finally, I would say that the one virtue that people see out of this big federal investment in health information technology, there's about $2 billion in this package just devoted to sheer research, how to come up with even better iterations of healthcare technology that exist now. There's another chunk of money devoted to creating regional extension centers, sort of like the old agricultural extension centers, to help providers work their way through these issues of adoption. So there are going to be lots of things out there that make life a little easier for the next generation of physicians who get into this. And already you can see Walmart just announced right after the stimulus law was signed, that they're bringing out an off-the-shelf system for practices that's about $22,000. You know, it's less than the price of a car, or at least less of a price than of the type of car many doctors would buy. Let's put it that way. So there's going to be a lot of innovation, I think, in this arena, and I think that to the degree that there's a lot of apprehension among some doctors, some of that is going to get taken care of with time, just because there will be more available for them and there will be more support to help them institutionalize it. And the final point I would make is that the law has bonuses in it for doctors to help them pay for this stuff, and hospitals as well. And then after a certain point, I believe it's in 2014, if physicians are not using these systems and haven't taken advantage of this free money from taxpayers to install the systems, then they'll start to be penalized in their Medicare payments for not using it. So their onus is going to be on physicians to make this conversion relatively quickly. And as I say, the goal is going to be to get better health care out the other end.
What about the hospitals who aren't sharing their records, except they go straight into, you know, billing people?
We are. I'm not sure that that's really true, Diane, and I want to move on because I get hospital records every day on my computer from both hospitals.
Well, I did read it on the website. So
yeah, those are solvable problems. We just got to get the connections, and doctors are not going to want to change. They haven't wanted to change very, very quickly. And having someone who's been doing it, there are problems, but I wouldn't go back either. So, thanks for your call. Let's go to our next caller, Torn. You're on line one.
Torn or Tom?
Tom. I'm sorry. I guess my eyes are getting bad. I apologize. It does say Tom. How are you?
Okay, fine. Thanks. My question to our guest is there, you made reference to the 50% additional cost that we have in this country per capita and the quality of our health care in terms of looking at our national data. Is there, in most of those countries that I'm aware of, there is some kind of national system, and we don't have, obviously, any system of care here. Is there any discussion of that at all back in D.C.? To structural reform in healthcare. I know I have occasion to work with a number of medical students. There certainly is interest in our current crop of medical students in working as, for example, as salaried physicians. Lifestyle questions and others are played there. But I get frustrated because people talk about different payment systems to keep these broken down belching car running.
I'm sorry. Go on.
No, I've said I get frustrated because all I hear about is really payment systems, and I must say we're all encouraged, I think, by the electronic health record discussion. But it's this: is there any really discussion back in D.C. if you've heard people even in the back of quiet halls talking about structurally the way we provide health care in this country?
There's an enormous amount of discussion and conversation about it, and the. An analysis that was done by McKinsey Global Institute, which is an arm of McKinsey, the McKinsey consulting firm, is instructive because essentially it looks at what we spend in the U.S. relative to everybody else. If you take the industrialized countries, the 30 largest industrialized countries, and plot them along a line and ask, if countries get richer, do they tend to spend more in health care? The answer is yes. And you can see this as per capita income goes up, country by country, the share of GDP that is devoted to health care rises. And it's pretty much of a steady line until you get the U.S., and then we're way above the line. We're just an outlier. We spend over and above our additional per capita income relative to other countries. We spend much more on health care. And this number that McKinsey came up with used to sound like a bigger number than it does now, but it's $650 billion a year in, quote, excess spending on health care, even taking into account the fact that we're a richer nation than these other big spenders, like per capita spenders like Switzerland and Luxembourg and so on. So where does that $650 billion go is the question. It goes, for example, in no particular order, $91 billion goes to excess administrative costs, over and above what we might be expected to spend. So it's health insurance, administration, and marketing is a big factor there. $44 billion in excess pharmaceutical costs, and that's kind of an interesting story. We get lower generic prices than any country in the world. We get the best break if you're on a generic drug. You know, you get a really good deal, and as we know now, you can get a $4 prescription from Walmart and many of the other big retail chains. So we get a huge break on generics relative to the rest of the world, but what we do pay more for is branded pharmaceutical drugs. So we're essentially underwriting the marketing expenses of the large pharmaceutical companies. And we also spend a whole lot on outpatient care, and that's been growing rather rapidly. And in fact, rather amazingly, spending on health care on a per capita basis grew 17% in just the years from 2003 to 2006. So we really have figured out a lot of places to spend money that ends up being considered money spent on healthcare that really doesn't buy actual additional units of health. It buys additional units of marketing of health insurance, or it buys additional units of drugs and drug marketing, and we all end up paying the cost. The essential issue, you know, if we want to keep all the things that we like about U.S. healthcare, and there are many indeed that we do, we have a lot of innovation, we have a lot of convenience relative to other countries. You don't have to stand in line for a long time to get an MRI. If we want to keep those aspects of it and still get better units of health, then we can see some areas where we could make a big difference. We could lower expenditures, outlays on administration and marketing. And some of the health insurers in this country now get that and have made a pledge to try to drive out those excess administrative costs out of their pricing structure. We'll see what happens, but at least they've made a commitment that they want to move in that direction. So we could probably just do a lot to keep the system we have or keep components of the system intact and save money on things that don't buy us additional units of health. And then I think a key question would become for us, well, what do we want to do to just improve the health status of Americans? And does that have anything to do necessarily with the healthcare system?
That's correct.
And in fact, a greater emphasis in this country on public health and on wellness and prevention is probably going to be a very important part of whatever we undertake as well, because some of those numbers that I mentioned earlier, the fact that we're 45th in life expectancy and 29th in infant mortality, those don't really so much speak to problems in our health care system as they speak to, are we making appropriate investments in the underlying health of our population? Are we doing the things that we ought to be doing in prevention? Are we doing what we should be doing right now to prevent obesity and particularly child obesity? You know, what are we really doing to maximize the health of the population, not just make healthcare better? And I think there's there's just a huge discussion now in Washington about what we could do that would be appropriate and cost effective to improve overall health. And that's a very important discussion to be had.
So we've been paying more and getting less, is what I hear.
That's pretty well documented. Yep.
Or certainly not getting enough, or buying lots of units of things that don't necessarily translate into better health.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. Along that line, I think the New England Journal series of articles made it very clear that it's surprising, but it's the new technology which is driving one of the big drivers of healthcare, increasing healthcare costs. And so it's nice to see at least that a small portion, I think $1 billion was put into the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act to look at comparative effectiveness research so that we can get some evidence that sometimes that the more expensive drugs and more expensive technologies don't necessarily lead to better outcomes.
Yes, and of course that in and of itself is a big topic of debate because I've mentioned the Women's Health Initiative study at the outset of this conversation. When that's all said and done, that study alone is going to cost about $1 billion. So putting $1 billion into comparative effectiveness research, frankly, is kind of a drop in the bucket.
Right.
And what the country is willing to spend on that kind of research is a big question. And then once that research is done, how is the information going to be used is another huge topic of debate, because there are many people who are fearful that it could lead to systems or even the government saying, well, if this research shows that this drug isn't that effective for you, a terminal cancer patient, we're just not going to pay for it. And, of course, that opens up the topic of rationing and makes people, frankly, many people very frightened that the long arm of the government, or if not the government, the long arm of some healthcare system is going to reach into your private life and tell you what you can and cannot spend money on to extend your life. And that, of course, is a very controversial topic.
Well, we certainly need good health journalism on this very, very important topic. I think there's more and more and more of us are aware that we need to be doing something different, and we need good information to help the public make those decisions, and that's what healthcare journalism is about. And it certainly has been a pleasure of mine to have you come on and talk to us about this, Susan.
Thanks so much, Dr. Woodward. It's been great to be with you.
All righty. Next week, we'll be back once again, and I want to thank again Susan Dentzer, the editor-in-chief of Health Affairs Journal, for being our guest this week. Next week, we're going to be discussing child abuse in a two-week program, and next week it'll be with Dr. Laura Jones, a local child psychologist, June Haston, and Amanda Metevier, and we'll be, like I said, talking about child abuse on Monday, March 31st at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.